Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Top UN humanitarians and chiefs of non-governmental organizations have warned about the catastrophic consequences of defunding UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, some of whose staff face allegations of collusion with Hamas. In a statement led by UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths, the 14 signatories insisted that despite horrifying allegations that 12 UNRWA staff were involved in the Hamas-led terror attacks on Israel on the 7th of October, we must not prevent an entire organization from delivering on its mandate to serve people in desperate need. The UN-led group of aid agencies, known collectively as the Interagency Standing Committee, also noted that withdrawing funds from UNRWA would have far-reaching humanitarian and human rights consequences in the occupied Palestinian territory and across the region. The development comes as hundreds of thousands of people have been left homeless and on the brink of famine amid ongoing heavy fighting and bombing in Gaza into Wednesday, particularly in the southern city of Khan Yunis. UNRWA is the largest aid agency in Gaza and provides a lifeline to more than 2 million people there. It has played a key role in education, healthcare and more in the enclave since 1949, when it was created by the UN General Assembly. Its future is in jeopardy after several major donors halted funds pending probes into Israel's allegations that 12 of the agency's 30,000 staff played a role in the 7th of October attacks and which are now under investigation. Violence in Haiti has triggered a deep humanitarian catastrophe, UN agencies have warned. According to the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, 170,000 youngsters are now displaced. This is double last year's number, and it comes amid a surge in gang-led killings and kidnappings, sexual violence, and a severe food crisis. The UNICEF representative in Haiti, Bruno Maes, who visited three displacement sites in downtown Port-au-Prince, said that children and families live in fear of relentless waves of brutal violence, with each day bringing new horrors, the loss of loved ones and homes being destroyed by fire. The latest UNICEF data from January 2024 indicates that nearly 314,000 people have been uprooted across Haiti, mostly in the capital, Port-au-Prince, and the Arbonite Department. Half are estimated to be children. In less than 2 weeks, nearly 2,500 people, most of them women and children, have been newly displaced following clashes in the areas of Solino and Gabeliste in Port-au-Prince. The violence has placed an enormous strain on already limited resources of host communities and social services, while hundreds of schools have had to shut temporarily, UNICEF said. To Hong Kong, where a top human rights expert has called for China to address torture claims in connection with the trial of Hong Kong pro-democracy media mogul Jimmy Lai. Special Rapporteur Alice Edwards warned on Wednesday that evidence obtained through torture must not be admissible, urging authorities to investigate allegations that evidence from a key prosecution witness had been obtained under duress. The absolute prohibition of reliance on evidence obtained as a result of torture or other ill treatment in any proceedings is a fundamental protection, Ms. Edwards said in her capacity as an independent UN-appointed expert who reports to the Human Rights Council in Geneva. Mr. Lai was arrested in August 2020 and charged with sedition and foreign collusion under a new security law following tweets, interviews and articles published in his newspaper, The Apple Daily. He was convicted of unauthorized assembly in 2021 for his participation in previous protests and sentenced to 17 months in prison. He was sentenced to an additional 5 years and 9 months for fraud in October 2022. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Thank you.
The world may think I'm wrong, but I just go along. I'm doing what I'm doing for love. Who gives but all the same? I be the one for blame for doing what I'm doing for love. I give up all I have, but I'm glad I did it for you. You little after years may bring tears, but what can I do? My broken made me down, but heaven will forgive me, cause I'm doing what I'm doing for love.
It's almost like we slipped right into springtime weather now. It's unbelievable. Hello, I'm your host and producer, Mike Cadell. I hope you're having a great day today. It's incredible. Expected 64 degrees Fahrenheit here today. I mean, it's serious business. Phone today with Dave Lindorf in the morning. It was a nice, it was talking about his book, A Spy for No Country, and it's continued, you know, I mean, it's of lasting value, especially in today's world with all the upheavals going on. A Spy for No Country. You'll hear more about that later. We've got, let's see, for the lineup today, the lineup is a little more music, and then we're going to have the headlines from Democracy Now!, the latest headline from this morning's broadcast, and then we'll have Law and Disorder. This is an interesting musician. Her name is Janet Klein, and she's out on the West Coast, and she's you can find her on YouTube, and she's puts out some great stuff. It's old-timey music, which I really sort of am partial to. Here's the Paradise Wobble.
Thank you. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials are accusing Israeli forces of carrying out execution-style killings in Gaza after the discovery of a mass grave containing at least 30 decomposing bodies. Some of the victims were blindfolded with their hands tied behind their backs with zip ties. The bodies were found on the grounds of a school in Beit Lahia. Al Jazeera spoke to one man who helped discover the bodies.
Inside the schoolyard, we were shocked to find the dead bodies. Those are Palestinian civilians, blindfolded and handcuffed at the back. The dead bodies were kept inside black plastic bags.
The discovery of the mass grave comes as the death toll in Gaza has topped 27,000. At least another 66,000 people have been injured. The group Euromed Human Rights Monitor is now estimating more than 25,000 Palestinian children have lost one or both parents in Gaza over the last 4 months. In central Gaza, the two largest hospitals in Khan Yunis have run out of food amidst Israel's assault on the city. Dr. Nassim Hassan, the head of the emergency unit at Nasser Hospital, denounced Israel's attacks on medical institutions.
We are talking about war and genocide against everyone. What's happening now in Gaza, since the beginning of the war until now, is a war against hospitals, a war against the healthcare system. Yes, hospitals have been destroyed, medical storehouses as well. Many ambulance vehicles were destroyed. Many EMS officers were martyred. There have been direct and indirect targeting of paramedics.
On the diplomatic front, Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh is reportedly in Cairo today as negotiations continue over a possible pause in the fighting and a new hostage deal. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's also headed back to Israel in the coming days. In more news on Gaza, South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, has called on all nations to halt military support to Israel after the International Court of Justice ordered Israel last week to prevent genocide in Gaza. Pandor spoke in Pretoria, South Africa.
This necessarily imposes an obligation on all states to cease funding and facilitating Israel's military actions, which, as the court has indicated, are plausibly genocidal.
In related news, a U.S. federal court has dismissed a lawsuit filed by a group of Palestinian Americans against President Biden and other officials for failing to prevent genocide in Gaza. The court dismissed the suit on jurisdictional grounds, but ruled it's plausible Israel's engaging in genocide. In its ruling, the court wrote, the evidence and testimony presented, quote, indicate the ongoing military siege in Gaza is intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly falls within the international prohibition against genocide, unquote. The lawsuit had been brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Visit democracynow.org to see our coverage of the case. U.S. forces have bombed Yemen again. U.S. Central Command said the attack targeted 10 Houthi drones and a ground control center. The Houthis have vowed to continue targeting ships linked to Israel and the United States until Israel halts its assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, NBC News is reporting President Biden's considering launching a weeks-long retaliatory campaign against Iran-backed militant groups following Sunday's deadly drone strike on a secret U.S. air base in Jordan that killed 3 U.S. soldiers. On Wednesday, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard said Tehran was, quote, not looking for war, unquote. One powerful Iraq-based militia group, Kataib Hezbollah, has announced it will halt operations targeting the United States in the region, saying it wanted to prevent embarrassment to the Iraqi government. The Biden administration accused the group of being involved in the Jordan drone attack. The Chicago City Council narrowly voted Wednesday to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Democratic Mayor Brandon Johnson cast the tie-breaking vote, which was met with an eruption of cheers from activists who gathered in the hundreds at Chicago City Hall to support the measure. Reverend Jesse Jackson was also present to show his support. At least 47 U.S. cities have passed resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, another Democratic mayor, Jacob Frey, vetoed a city council resolution calling for a ceasefire that was passed last week. Fry said the measure was too one-sided in favor of Palestinians and that he's open to signing a ceasefire resolution that's more, quote, unquote, unifying. The resolution was passed with a veto-proof majority, so council members could still decide to override the mayor's veto. Protests against the U.S.-funded war in Gaza continue across the United States. Activists have been camped outside the Virginia home of Secretary of State Antony Blinken for a week, loudly chanting slogans through megaphones like Secretary of Genocide and encouraging passing cars to honk. On Capitol Hill, five activists with Code Pink were arrested earlier this week as the group disrupted a House hearing on the U.S.'s decision to suspend funding for UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees. Yesterday, members of the Arab American community in Dearborn, Michigan, gathered to protest against President Biden ahead of his visit today to the key swing state and just weeks ahead of Michigan's February 27th presidential primary.
I voted for Bernie Sanders, which tells you where I was on the spectrum. And to have a person like me to go from that extreme to say that I'm now willing to vote for Trump in order to oust Genocide Joe, it's really a testament to how Biden has lost big time within my community.
Kenyan President William Ruto is vowing to proceed with a plan to send 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti despite a court ruling that the deployment would be unconstitutional. The UN Security Council approved the mission last year as part of an effort to help combat gang violence, which has grown under Haiti's unelected leader, the U.S.-backed Ariel Henry, who's ruled since the 2021 assassination of Jovenel Moïse. Meanwhile, the UN and aid groups are warning about a surge in sexual assaults and collective rapes in Haiti as gangs fight to expand their power. On Wednesday, protesters in Port-au-Prince burned barricades to protest Prime Minister Ariel Henry's rule.
The people can't take it anymore because Ariel Henry is building gangs to plunder and destroy these people. Well, today we say that the battle for the revolution is possible. The final fight for justice is possible. We must disrupt this Ariel with all his team to give this country another direction.
In Belgium, farmers from across Europe have converged in the capital of Brussels, calling on European Union leaders to end free trade agreements that allow cheaper goods to dominate the market and ease environmental regulations. Hundreds of tractors have taken over Luxembourg Square near the European Parliament. Farmers clash with police, who hose some of the protesters with water. This is an Italian farmer.
First of all, we decided to come here to join with other kind of European young farmers to create a unique voice, not against, but with the cooperation of the European Parliament and the other kind of politics, because we'd like to safeguard our tradition, our farmers' moods, our quality of food, but to safeguard the majority part of this kind of situation, the dignified incomes.
The farmer protests, which started in France but soon spread across the EU, have disrupted traffic and led to confrontations with police in recent weeks and rising tensions ahead of today's EU summit. Some far-right nationalist leaders have seized on the movement to gain traction and foment anti-EU sentiment, including France's Marine Le Pen and the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who met with farmers in Brussels earlier today. A sweeping new government study finds contaminated water at the Camp Lejeune military base in North Carolina led to elevated cancer rates among people who lived and worked at Lejeune decades ago. Previous studies linked the drinking water at the base to blood and organ cancers and Parkinson's disease, victims of the contamination which plagued Camp Lejeune from at least 1953 to 1987, have for years been fighting for compensation and recognition from the U.S. government. The new findings are likely to boost their legal claims, which they have until August to file under a new federal law. Over 160,000 claims have been filed so far. On Capitol Hill, senators on the Judiciary Committee grilled the CEOs of Meta, TikTok, X, Snapchat, and Discord Wednesday, arguing social media companies must be held accountable for the sexual exploitation of children that their apps facilitate and the harmful effects of their products on the mental health of young people. This is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham addressing Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
You and the companies before us, I know you don't mean it to be so, but you have blood on your hands. You have a product. You have a product that's killing people. When we had cigarettes killing people, we did some about it, maybe not enough. You're going to talk about guns? We have the ATF. Nothing here. There's not a damn thing anybody can do about it. You can't be sued.
In one of the session's most sensational moments, Mark Zuckerberg stood up and awkwardly apologized to the families who were present at the hearing after being pressured by Republican Senator Josh Hawley.
I'm sorry for everything that you've all gone through. It's terrible. No one should have to go through the things that your families have suffered. And this is why we invest so much and are going to continue doing industry-leading efforts to make sure that no one has to go through the types of things that your families have had to suffer.
Many families held up photos of their children who died or were harmed by social media. Snapchat CEO Evan Spiegel also directly apologized to families after prompting from California Democrat LaFonza Butler. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Tom Cotton hounded TikTok CEO Suzy Chew, who is Singaporean, over citizenship and ties to the Chinese government.
Have you ever been a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm Singaporean. No.
Have you ever been associated or affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party?
No, Senator. Again, okay. I'm Singaporean.
Senator Cotton and Republican colleagues have called for TikTok to be banned, claiming it's a spy app for the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, the House Wednesday passed a $78 billion bill that would expand the child tax credit while reviving some corporate tax breaks. While hailed as a bipartisan victory by centrist lawmakers, around two dozen Democrats voted against it. Progressive congressmember from Texas, Greg Kassar, was one of them, arguing, quote, in exchange for a partial return of the child tax credit, Republicans got hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate tax cuts. For every dollar going to kids in this bill, $5 goes to corporations. We have the money to pull every child in America out of poverty. We just need to say no to accepting crumbs while corporations get a full steak dinner, Kassar said. A Delaware judge has voided the $56 billion compensation package of Tesla CEO Elon Musk. The judge noted the astronomical 2018 pay package was the largest ever in public corporate history, and that Tesla's board failed to prove the compensation plan was fair. And in more related news, Senator Bernie Sanders and Democratic lawmakers are pushing a union-backed bill that would raise taxes on companies where CEOs make more than 50 times above the salary of an average worker. The measure could raise $150 billion in revenue over a decade. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Hello, we're back. We're going to have some more, a medley of more hits from the roaring 20s of the previous century. give you a hint. Steve Buscemi, I think that's how you pronounce his name, the legendary actor, starred in it, and it was about the 20s, the roaring 20s. And let's see, I'll tell you who the great orchestra and the history of this sheet music next time. Hold on. Here we go with another one. You figured out where the music comes from? Remember, well, you know, Steve Buscemi. I hope I've got his name right. If not, I am sorry. He starred in Fargo. He's a Coen guy. He's like, that's where he made it. Fargo is one of them he starred in. The Big Lebowski. Steve Buscemi. This is unusual. This is not produced by the Coen brothers. This series, I believe it was on HBO. Here's another one.
Far away in Jumbo Jumbo lived a girl named Simbo Sambo, and they say this little Sambo steals her heart away. When they hear her pretty lingo, they fall for this dark skinned bimbo. I am
Have you figured it out yet? It's Boardwalk Empire. That's right. That's the name of the series, the HBO series. And these, the story, the backstory about this music is that a lot of this is raw sheet music discovered in a warehouse by Vince Giordano, that's his name, and he heard about it, and it's sort of nebulous, but anyhow, they went in there and selected sheet music and a lot gobs of it, and this is what they came up with. It's all original stuff from the 20s, recorded in modern studios. So that's why the quality is so good. You don't have all the scratchy stuff, you know, which you're going to hear a little bit later in the hour here. We're going to be starting. Hopefully we'll have the latest Law and Disorder. We're uploading it right now as we speak. And, but until then, we'll finish off the tribute to Boardwalk Empire. And Nucky, that was the name of the character played. It's really a great limited series. And this is probably one of the most popular of the songs that I've heard. I've heard it in other places that came out of it. And Vince Giordano and his Nighthawk Orchestra. That's the name of the group that did all these recordings. All right, here we go. This is the last one, then I'll move on to some scratchy stuff. most popular hit from Boardwalk Empire of the depicting the roaring 20s of the last century. And we're in the roaring 20s now, I seem to think, in certain respects. And we've got a caller come in. We've got plenty of time here to visit. I'm going to butcher your name, buddy, but I'm going to put you on air. Piake, I think, something like that. Let's see if I get you on
air.
Okay, Piake. Go ahead. Take it off.
Well, I'm coming to know this genocide that's going on in Palestine by this Israeli occupying government.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand. You know, the United States has used that government over there as a money laundering scheme for a long time. Uh-huh. Aid goes over and it comes back into their lobbyist group, AIPAC, and then it's distributed amongst politicians that carry out their wishes. Now, you just had a recent...
The actual, it's a $3.4 to $3.8 billion a year. And there's a percentage of that is supposed to be arms, largely arms, armaments, bombs, and stuff like that.
Yes, it is.
You know,
and your defense contractors contribute to the campaign of these politicians. Let me give you an example just recently.
Go ahead. All right.
You had AIPAC say they're going to raise $100 million to get rid of these women in the squad, basically black women, out of Congress. Well, see, that there is a problematic because their constituents voted them in, and it should be their constituents that remove them, not some outside interest group. And I'm sure you would agree with that. I hear we complain about Soros and his contributions that go against the U.S. constitutional foundational of means, the Second Amendment, and so on and so on. So can't we say the same thing is happening with AIPAC?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it is sort of a big problem for them in terms of it's a problem. I don't think it matters whether it's Biden or Trump at the switch, you know, in many respects. I think, and I was surprised to see Biden do this so quickly and so emphatically, but we should have known that when he started $150 billion in aid, and Congress supported him on that to Ukraine. So, I mean, it's sort of the only thing I could think good about this is that it's all out in the open. I mean, the rise.
Yeah, it
of the
is because you know why it's out in the open? Because their time is running out. That's why it's out in the open. The cover is about ready to be thrown off. The curtain is about ready to be pulled back to see the man that's behind the curtain as in the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Their time is running out.
Well, it is ready to
be. Even Ukraine. Ukraine. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Thanks for that. But even with the Ukraine, it's nothing more than a boomerang. Money goes over, unaccounted for. It's like a boomerang. It comes back around in the back door of these politicians' campaign.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a volunteer. Go ahead.
I gotta give you a question. When do you think Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is going to get finally more honest, appear on Saturday Night Live, and ask for money?
You know, Zelensky is a Jew. Did you know that?
Well, and he was allegedly he was elected president as saying he was gonna as a peace candidate. He was gonna make peace with Russia. He got elected, and look what happened. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's crazy.
Let me ask you something. Do you fear Russia?
Mm. No. I think in certain respects, I think Putin is He's doing they want to, basically the eastern third of Ukraine, because the people in that area set up the Donetsk People's Republic. I mean, they set up their own separate governments, voted to be away after, in I think it was 2013, after the Ukrainian fascists were shooting artillery rounds, and the United Nations had people there counting them. 13,000 artillery rounds are fired into Donetsk and Luhansk cities in eastern Ukraine. These are the very same power centers on the eastern Ukraine that Putin is trying to protect, and they're all.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question.
They want to be. They want to be part of Russia.
You know why? You know why? Because Russia protects them during World War II.
Yeah, and
right. Russia is not no enemy of ours. Do an inventory of the things you have in your house. You think you will find something made in Russia?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, and the Chinese.
So where is it all made?
Yeah.
It's made in China. Everything down to your drawers.
It's not only here; it's all in Europe and it's worldwide. China has 40% of the world's market in manufactured goods.
They have.
I mean, that's a huge chunk. The U.S. has, I think, less than 20%. Go ahead.
I don't know if you're religious or not, and you believe in the return of Jesus. Where is he supposed to return at? Tell us something. Well, let me ask you a question.
Now that's a theological question.
I think
it's sort of a. You may be onto something.
Let me finish. Go ahead.
You're on it.
Why would you return someplace where nobody wants you? Why don't you go to Rome? If he returns there and people that's going to go with him have to go there, they going to get killed.
Yeah.
I'm not going any place where nobody wants me. You go to places where you're welcome.
Yeah. Is there poetry and tragedy? Because I think, it does make, it's almost poetic. You bring up this contradiction about Christ reappearing or whatever in Palestine. I mean, that's the very, there's a guy, another old guy I listened to, he quoted an old farmer out in western Kansas, nowhere land. And he said, hell, these people have been trying to kill each other for thousands of years. Why do we expect them to stop now? Now, this is, in a prior bloody conflict, not this current one we're in, which is bigger than most of them now. I mean, here's a question. I think what's shocking to the world is how many are being killed so quickly. It seems amazing, doesn't it? I think the world, what do you think? The world, is that what it is?
No, I'm going to tell you exactly what you have. You have a white government in Palestine that you want to call Israel. They need to go back to Poland, Germany, and come back to the United States. Have you ever looked at that government? They're not from there.
It's European. It was a European decision as well as our, I guess.
They are from Europe, Germany, further into Poland, and also United States. That's where they're from. And there's never going to be, even Nasser, he said you left here black and you returned white. All it is an occupation. When Theodore Herzl came up with the idea, and Arthur Balfour, who was a staunch racist, they was choosing in discussion making Uganda. And Central Africa as the place of return.
I did not
the
know
Ugandan
that.
The Ugandan president, Idi Amin, trained in Israel. Then he came back and he said, y'all ain't coming over here. But they want the natural resources in that country.
Well, when this thing started, my friend asked me, I said, well, first thing, look at land and water. And then a port, a beach, so you can have a port. I mean, those are the three ingredients for a functioning country, you know. And I think that's what they're fundamentally. I've seen, and I haven't been able to screen grab it quick enough, but there were, I guess, the Israeli Zionist Israelis are setting up dreams and drawing, have architectural drawings of like a. Looks like something like Las Vegas on the beach, you know, to replace the Gaza Strip. And
yes,
I'm like,
they're doing all those things.
They're dreaming
they're
of that stuff.
It.
And,
it
I
ain't
mean,
gonna
that
happen.
Is, that,
it ain't gonna be no that, peace. And see, here it is. You know, you've heard the old terminology, tit for tat. I'm gonna get you back.
Mm-hmm.
It never will stop. Until they get them out of their country. And they're talking about a two-state solution. You think that they're going to divide the country? It ain't going to happen.
They tried to divide it, and it didn't work. The settlers came in, and the army tanks come in and bulldoze all these trees and take over the homes. I mean, or demolish them. And, I think what they had, you know, but let's think. Let's think the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, led by a South African woman. You know, if the word is apartheid, in 1985, 86, I was involved in those years in the anti-apartheid movements here in the United States. And that if Israel is an apartheid state, that what was the key solution? The big solution was universal suffrage. Everybody has a right to vote, and there are, I guess, in the West Bank, 30,000 Palestinian Israelis, but it's sort of it's like they're not letting all the Palestinians have all the civil rights that they need
when they had that fake Solomon Airlift bringing Beta. Beta is Ethiopian from Gondor. I've been to Gondor. You know what Beta means? Beta means house.
No.
House. Beta is Rehuda. They are some of the people that's been there for time memorial. There was no country called Israel. It was made up. When they brought them back, they sterilized the black Ethiopian women. And I don't know how they done this next thing. They recircumcised the male. How the hell are you going to do that? That just sounds crazy.
Yeah, sounds crazy.
So
that's crazy.
When you look at a people and the things that they do and the things that they say, you can correlate that with something that you've either heard or experienced in the past. And you say, this is these people. They're very evil and demonic. And the time is going to come for them sooner or later. You don't do that to people.
Well, I'm glad you called in, PK. And one other thing, real quick.
I don't know if you, when you look at your birth certificate, does it say that you was born a Baptist, a Lutheran, a Catholic, or a Jew?
No one's born in
ethnic groups. You buy into that. Look at Sammy Davis Jr. He was a Jew. Look at Whoopi Goldberg. And also look at Castro. He was a Christian by day and a Jew by night. He was a Marengo. All right, I'll let you get back to your music.
Thank you. We're gonna go directly to Law and Disorder, the latest edition. Thank you. PQ, see ya.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we ask the question, is the Israeli-Palestinian war about to become a wider war involving many more nations.
Our guest on this topic explains where the war has already spread and why there is great danger of it spreading even further.
Then we'll look to the results of the most recent UN gathering of nations addressing the climate change crisis.
Our guest, an expert on this topic, will argue that while the situation remains bleak, there is still much reason for hope. Stay with us.
I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
One issue flowing from the Israeli-Palestinian war, at first pretty much ignored, is the danger of the war widening. And as Israel's war in Gaza drags on with no end yet in sight, the threat of such a much wider war does grow stronger and stronger. Already the war has resulted in military action in Syria and Iraq by forces loyal to Iran. U.S. military facilities have been targeted in Iraq by Iranian-backed forces. The United States and Great Britain are now regularly bombing Houthi military installations in response to the Houthis militarily disrupting the free flow of shipping in the Gulf region on behalf of their support for Palestine. And there are now daily clashes between Hezbollah in Lebanon and Israel across their shared border. So far, the adversaries have been careful to not go beyond an unspoken but generally recognized tipping point or red line so as to not bring about open nation-on-nation warfare throughout the region. But a slippery slope has now been created that many fear could bring about what would amount to a world war, even if confined only to that part of the world. And if that happens, who knows how many other nations in the Middle East would end up drawn into such a wider war. So to help us understand and evaluate this threat of a much wider war resulting from the Israeli-Palestinian war, we're fortunate to have with us as our guest today an expert on that region of the world. Our guest is Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition, or ANSWR. He is the author of the highly praised book, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, published in 2013 and with an updated edition of the book about to be released as well. He is also the author of the book entitled The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. And Richard Becker is a national leader in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Richard Becker, a warm welcome to the Law and Disorder Show.
Well, great. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Absolutely. So far, every one of the nations who've become involved in any ways in what we might call the wider war with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian war have entered the war or playing a role in the war on behalf of the Palestinian cause. They're taking military actions against Israel and the U.S., or in the case of the Houthis from Yemen, against Great Britain as well. In the case of North Korea, they are actually providing weapons to Hamas in Gaza. Should this surprise us, really, or should the leaders of Israel and the U.S. and Great Britain have expected these other nations might become involved in whatever degree and on behalf of the Palestinian cause? And in that regard, I can't help but wonder to what extent is how the war is being conducted and how long it is dragging on, does it not have something to do with Netanyahu's own dire political and legal situation within Israel itself? His popularity is at an all-time low. They're calling for new leadership, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's a mouthful of a question, so work away at it, my friend.
Well, I would say, first of all, that Netanyahu is both acting out of personal interest. That is, he wants the war to go on and on. He wants an expanded war, I think. I don't think there's much question about that. And whether he can have a wider war, the U.S. has a lot to say about that. What is happening today is really a continuation of what's been going on since 1948, which is the dispersal, the removal, the transfer is the word that the Zionists who formed the State of Israel like to use, the transfer of the population, the Palestinian population, out of Palestine. We see that in the continuation of the war at the behest of Netanyahu and his refusal to acknowledge any rights for the Palestinian people, these things fit together. As far as the earlier part of what you were saying, you know, in the entire Arab world, and much broader than that, but let me just say about the Arab world, the many Arab countries, the population is overwhelmingly, I mean 99%, in support of the Palestinians. And for those who are in states in countries which are Arab countries which are not, or predominantly Arab countries which are not participating in action against Israel in support of the Palestinians, the population in those countries wishes they were. To what extent they can do it, that's another question. But I think it reaffirms the fact that there is, in fact, an Arab nation that goes beyond the countries and the way that they were divided by imperialism, by colonialism, but there's a commonality of sentiment and view and culture and language that we see being reaffirmed by what's happening today.
Iran for a long time now has been an enemy of the West, an enemy of the United States. Remind our listeners of the way in which military forces that it backs in other countries have been carrying out Iran's efforts to strike blows against Israel and the West. It has done so, has it not, in such a way that while it's no secret that Iran is behind these attacks in this widening war, how they've done it leaves them with some degree of deniability, leaves them not having gone so far as to cross a line whereby the U.S. and our Western allies, or the governing forces in Syria or Iraq, have been forced to respond in kind. That would seem to indicate that Iran is, in fact, being careful not to cross a line where they can be seen as officially spreading war. But still, that does not fully eliminate the possibility that what they are doing is nonetheless spreading war, does it?
Well, it's very interesting. Your question is an interesting, very interesting question. I would say more, you know, from the Iranian point of view, the U.S. and the West, but especially the U.S., are the enemies of Iran. Iran didn't overthrow the U.S. government in 1953, but the U.S., the CIA, and the British intelligence collaborated to overthrow the Iranian government, the first democratic government in Iran, and then that led into 25 years, from 1953 to 1978, to a brutal, brutal police state regime where the secret police, known as the Sabak, were trained by the United States. Norman Schwarzkopf's father, the guy who was the commander from the Iraq War's father, the first Iraq War's father, he was the trainer. And torture was extremely widespread. Thousands, tens of thousands of young Iranians were killed. The country was opened up to the U.S. It was exploited. The people were treated like dirt, the masses of people, until the revolution in 1978. So if we want to know where the hostility from the Iranian side comes from, it has a material basis. As far as the countries, the various countries or organizations, again, there's a question that has to be raised. Like, that is frequently it's said there's U.S. or Iranian-backed militias in Syria, Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, Hezbollah, Iranian-backed Hezbollah. And, of course, they never say, you know, the Israeli, U.S.-backed Israeli forces. That's forbidden to say in the media. That language can't be used. But you have to ask the question first, like, what's the source of hostility in those countries? They, too, have suffered. You know, Iraq suffered two wars at the hands of the United States. Syria is partially occupied today. There's U.S. troops there. What are they – the question is never raised, and I welcome the opportunity to say something about it. What are the U.S. troops doing in Syria? What are the U.S. troops doing in Iraq? Why are they subject to attack? Because they're occupiers. Occupation is not popular. Occupation is never popular. So as far as the question of deniability and so forth, we don't really know what to make of all of that. I think that the most accurate representation of the axis of resistance, as it's called, and includes Iran, Syrian government, militia forces and popular forces inside of Iraq, Hezbollah, in Yemen, the Houthi led movement, which is, I think is more than just that movement, Hamas and other forces in Palestine. And so all of those forces have a kind of an alliance, but they all act fundamentally on their on the national interest. And I think this has been, you know, said as well, even by some figures in the U.S. who are more realistic and not just demonizing everybody in the region.
I want to make it clear. I think your answer to that question is exactly right, and I don't think either Maria and I meant to suggest otherwise. Perhaps our question was a little awkward, and I thank you for clearing it up, because you're quite right as to who has made who the enemy in the situation and what Iran is doing and so forth. And so thank you for that. But let's talk now also about what the Houthis of Yemen have been doing. They've been attacking commercial ships passing through their area of the world on behalf of imposing a financial cost to the world as a consequence of Israel's war in Palestine and how the Western world is supporting Israel, in the hopes, of course, of the part of the Houthis of causing the Western world to perhaps pressure Israel to end the damn war in Palestine. And so I'm wondering, in response to that, of course, the U.S. and Great Britain are now bombing Yemen's Houthi fighters, causing Houthi fatalities as the Houthis attack these commercial ships. It's an example of that widening war we're talking about. The U.S. says it doesn't want a wider war, but nevertheless, the Biden administration, while acknowledging little success so far in ending the Houthi attacks, nevertheless claims it intends to keep on attacking them more or less indefinitely. Isn't that a situation that could eventually lead to yet a much further widening of the war, if that's the Biden administration's position?
Yeah, so Biden was asked in a press conference about a week ago whether or not he thought that the bombing that was being carried out by the U.S. and British, and by the way, the British are the former colonizers of Yemen, so they're back, but that he was asked, do you think that's going to solve the problem? And he said, no, probably not, something to that effect, I'm paraphrasing, but he said no. And then he said, well, are you going to continue the bombing? And he said, yes. I mean, like, what do you think you're going to really do? I mean, it's very interesting that 8.5 years ago, Saudi Arabia and UAE, with the full backing of the United States, and again, it doesn't say the U.S.-backed Saudi forces in the media here, but they started a war. They thought the war would be over in a few weeks against Yemen, against the Houthi-led movement in Yemen. 8 years later, they had to sue for peace. They had not succeeded, and the Yemeni forces have gotten much stronger. I mean, Yemen is in a humanitarian crisis. There's a lot of hunger, malnutrition, shortages, sanctions, all of that. But their military forces are clearly much, much stronger than they were in 2015. They have a regular army now. It was a militia before. They have all kinds of different military equipment and military capabilities. And so they're not going away, and they're not going to stop. And, you know, also I have to point out that the Red Sea is not an American lake. You know, this is, again, like kind of the assumption in the U.S. media is that it's all fine for U.S., all those U.S. ships to be in the Red Sea. As a matter of fact, last week there was a headline that said, Iranian ship enters Red Sea, raising tensions. So it's like the aircraft carriers and the nuclear-armed submarines and the battleships and the destroyers from the U.S. and Britain, they don't cause tensions. It's one Iranian ship causes an increase in tension in the region.
Dick Becker, the situation on the Israeli-Lebanon border seems to be constituting a war of its own, albeit limited, between Lebanon and Israel. I mean, unlike the case where Iranian proxy forces are carrying out military actions on other nations like Iraq, through groups they support but not with Iranian troops directly, Israel and Hezbollah, Lebanon, are in direct conflict. How do you see this fact relating to the question of whether or not the Israeli-Palestinian war becomes a wider war? I mean, hasn't it already done so in the case of Lebanon and Israel?
Yes, it has. It has become a wider war already. But I think we would have to say it's a limited war at this point. It's not like the war. In 2006, there was a confrontation at the border. And that led to Israeli forces going into Lebanon. They had occupied Lebanon from 1982, really from president from 1978 till 2000 until the resistance drove them out. In that war, the U.S. was very much in favor of the war. The Israeli government felt that they could win the war, and at the beginning, the U.S. refused to call for a ceasefire at the United Nations. I remember well Condoleezza Rice saying, you know, that this is a birth pangs of the new Middle East. This is as Israel was buying the hell out of Beirut, the capital, and destroying the much the way we see them destroying in Gaza now. And then a few weeks later, they had to go to the United Nations, and they were losing the war, and they were losing so badly, they had to stop. Israel had to withdraw, and they suffered a lot of casualties. Lebanon, though, and I think this is a big factor in relation to your question, Lebanon suffered immense damage to its civilian infrastructure. And the Israeli government and the U.S. government, Lloyd Austin in particular, have been issuing these warnings, and this is why the U.S. sent the aircraft carrier, another aircraft carrier to the region, to threaten Lebanon to the Mediterranean, from the Mediterranean, and threatening the Israelis, saying, we'll do to Lebanon what was just done to Gaza if the war goes further. So that's a big, big thing that Hezbollah, while they're 1,000% in support of the Palestinians, not altogether in support of the Palestinians, they have to take into account what the consequences of a wider war would be.
This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host today, Maria Hall, here on Law and Disorder. At the moment, talking with Richard Becker about the widening war between Israel and Palestine. Let's talk a bit about China and Russia, North Korea and such. We've mentioned that North Korea has been supplying the Palestinians with weapons and so forth. But it's no secret that the U.S. is in a constant state of at least a Cold War, if not more, with Russia and China. Talk to us about how the Israeli-Palestinian war either feeds into or relates to or exacerbates in any way that conflict.
I think that the war that's going on, Israel's war against the Palestinians in Gaza, has led to, verifiable by a huge decline in not only Israel's standing in the world, but the U.S. standing in the world. And recent polls have shown, like, that since October 7th, there's been an 18% drop in favorability rating of Israel, and a lesser drop, but still a significant drop in favorability worldwide. And this, I'm not sure who, Global Initiatives or something like that, some big polling firm did this around the world, a big decline in the U.S. standing in the world. So that's important, very important from the point of view of, like, how the alignment of forces is taking place. There are different bodies now. There's BRICS, which is expanding. Russia and China have a stronger alliance, a military alliance, than they've had perhaps since the time of the early 1960s. And, of course, NATO has also grown, but there's also discontent within NATO. There's discontent about the Ukraine war. So, you can just see what happened in regard to Saudi Arabia's moving toward normalization of relations with Israel before October 7th. That came to a screeching halt. 99% of Saudis, in opinion polls there, are on the side of the Palestinians and don't want to have normalization, now don't have one normalization with Israel. It's really changed things. It's really changed the world scene in a lot of ways. And I think that goes not only for the Saudi Arabia, but the other monarchies as well. They all have to, who are very reactionary, but they have to pull back from that what was going on under Trump, the Abraham Accords and the normalization of relations between Israel and a number of the Arab countries with more reactionary governments. So it's had a big impact, and including, of course, as you suggested at the beginning, Jim, that in regard to China and Russia, China is really the top priority for the U.S. and the preparations for war and seeking government, the overthrow, regime change in China, That remains, you know, at the top of the agenda. But you can see that the U.S. position is worldwide is declining because of this war and other factors as well, but particularly because of the war.
What, Dick Becker, in your mind, is the best or perhaps the only solution to the now 75 years of Israel's war and occupation of Palestine? The two-state solution, the one-state solution, or something else?
Well, I've always considered, and I've been an activist on the issue for many decades now, but and I've always said, you know, this is something, the solution has to come from the people there. And particularly, there has to be self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the apartheid, it's an apartheid system in that the Palestinians live under. There's about an equal number of Palestinians and Israel and Jewish Israelis in Palestine, Israel today. But the Palestinians live under completely different conditions. Those who are inside the 48 borders are second-class citizens or third-class citizens. Those who live in the West Bank are subject to what is really a system of apartheid. And this has now been documented in lengthy reports, not just by Palestinian organizations, by Israeli organizations, B'Tselem, Human in the U.S., Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Organizations I never thought would do this have put out documented reports before October 7th of the apartheid character of what the Palestinians have to live under. Apartheid cannot be sustained. And you can't claim to be in a democratic state if you have an apartheid regime. You know, just West Bank, the settlers live under Israeli civilian law. All the Palestinians are governed under emergency military regulations borrowed by Israel from the British colonizers when the British colonizers pulled out. So, you know, I think that that's what apartheid has to end. The apartheid system in Israel, Israel's apartheid regime rule over the Palestinians must end. And then from there, we go forward.
As we get near the end of our time today, you've made the point that the West's war on the Palestinian people, Israel's war on the Palestinian people is, well, it's gone on for really 75 years now, hasn't it? But in terms of this current war, what is now your judgment as to, based on what we've been talking about, things you've been, I know, thinking and writing about, what is your overall judgment as to whether or not we can look for any kind of an ending of this round of the war anytime soon? Is it likely to drag, and drag on? Give us your thoughts, please, on that.
Well, it's kind of remarkable that the fighting is still going on. You know, this is a very small area. The Gaza is a very small area. And Israel has, you know, all kinds of weapons, I mean, an incredible array of weapons provided by the U.S. and by its own military industrial establishment. And the fact that they have not succeeded yet in subduing the Palestinians, nor is there any prospect of that happening now in the near term. The New York Times has an article today citing Israeli sources and Netanyahu and others there in the Israeli establishment talking about the war continuing to the middle of 2025. That's a year and a half from now. Of course, part of that is Netanyahu wants the war to go on forever so he can't be prosecuted. But I don't think there's any sign of the fighting ending anytime soon. I mean, there's a vast discrepancy. It's so vast. I think there's been now 28 emergency resupply operations from the U.S. to Israel, and mostly involving ammunition and bombs and other military equipment. There's no, of course, no such weaponry coming from anywhere to or other needed supplies coming to the Palestinians who are resisting inside of Gaza. But I think it will go on. I don't think it's about to end.
I know your book, your wonderful book on that area of the world, has been republished. I think it's already available And tell us how our listeners could get a hold of it, which I would really urge them to do if they want to have a deeper and a meaningful understanding of what's going on beyond what you get from the corporate media in America, of course.
Yeah, it's available. The republication is available through 1804.org, that website. This is 1804 Books, which is a great bookseller, great progressive bookseller. And I really do urge people to get a copy. It's a resource for activists. It's not an academic book. It explains the evolution of this whole struggle and the development of the state of Israel through and their intention to displace the Palestinians through the words of the Zionist and then Israeli leaders. And so I think that's very important. And also it explains, has a question, is Israel an apartheid state? Spoiler alert, yes. Why does the Israeli lobby control U.S. foreign policy? No, but with a lot of explanation of why $3.8 billion a year goes from the U.S. to Israel and much, much more in the way of real support. So 1804.org, 1804.org.
Richard, thank you. Richard Becker, thank you so much for being with us today here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
It has been all too slowly the reality of climate change and what it means for life on our planet, for human lives and the lives of the multitude of other life forms we share this planet with, has become clearer and clearer to all who've, well, not buried their heads in the sand and closed their eyes and minds to this deadly reality. For a few decades now, we humans have been paying more and more attention to the issue. We have actually instituted some measures aimed at holding climate change in check, but so far with pitifully little effect. In fact, despite these more recent efforts, those greenhouse gases just keep reaching for the sky in greater and greater amounts every year. Is it hopeless? That is, are we humans hopelessly unwilling and unable to do what the science on the matter makes clear must be done if we're not going to find ourselves rather soon on our way to extinction, or at least living in an unlivable planet? Are there, in fact, things we could and should be doing that would actually work? Well, today we're going to be joined by an expert on climate change to help us answer these and other questions, to let us know what would, if we had the will to do so, actually work on behalf of preventing this cataclysmic disaster. Our guest is Professor Eleanor Stein. Professor Stein is a climate change, environmental justice, and human rights activist and advocate. She teaches climate change and human rights at the State University of New York at Albany and has just recorded a continuing legal education session on this subject for the CUNY Law School. In addition, she facilitates international forums on climate change and energy. And for years, Professor Stein was an administrative law judge for the New York State agency that regulates the energy industry. She guided state policy on recovery from Superstorm Sandy 10 years ago. In this regard, her work centered on mediating processes to bring solar and wind energy to the state at scale, at speed, and with justice. So, Eleanor Stein, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here again.
Oh, absolutely.
Eleanor, let's first take a look, take stock, really, of where we're at on the climate crisis today. It seems that the situation grows more and more dire with every passing year. You know, icebergs melting faster than we thought. The amount of greenhouse gases still going up more every year. Last year, hottest year on record. This year, in fact, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved its famous doomsday clock to 90 seconds before midnight, the closest to doomsday it's ever been, in part because of the climate crisis. Alarmingly, we're certainly further down the road with respect to reaching various so-called tipping points. Recently, of course, there was the COP28 United Nations Climate Conference, this time drawing, and in fact, the largest attendance ever. I guess that's good, including the presence of, 150 heads of state. So using as our guide that the Global Tipping Points report launched at that conference and back December here, December 6th, I think it was, of last year, tell us, where matters stand today according to this latest report, and is there other evidence of the acceleration in reaching these tipping points, well, that perhaps the report failed to address?
I'd be glad to start there, and we'll see where it takes us. The report is a great piece of work, and I think it was intended to really shake up the attendees at COP28 in Dubai. And unfortunately, although the attendance was enormous, the impact of that conference was probably one of the least significant of any on record because, you know, think about it for a minute. You're holding a global climate summit and you're holding it in a petrostate. And not only this year, but next year is going to be at Azerbaijan, another petrostate. And in Dubai, the head, the chairman of the conference, is also the CEO of the state oil company. So, in many ways, the outcome was better than could have been expected. There were some statements in principle that are important, like an agreement that we're trying to phase down and phase out fossil fuels. That's never been said explicitly, although it's certainly implied in previous conferences. And there was an agreement on methane that was significant, and there was an agreement on a loss and damage fund. But here's an example of the problem. The language of the Loss and Damage Fund is very ringing and impressive, but then they collected the pledges for how much the world's richest nations were going to contribute. This is to help the Global South address a sort of irreversible, irretrievable losses suffered by climate change impacts in the past. The United States pledged $17.5 million subject to congressional approval. Now, 10 years ago, at the Cancun conference, Hillary Clinton suggested that the fund should be at $100 billion a year. So if you think about the United States pledging a conditional $17.5 million, that kind of stands as an index of exactly the significance of the decisions that were made. On the other hand, I know people who attended who felt that the progress was made in terms of building the alliances and the organizational, you know, partnerships among nations from the Global South and nations and representatives of people of color communities in the United States in terms of moving ahead in the future to work together. And it's interesting because the Tipping Points report, which was, you know, most strikingly about 5+ disasters rated, you know, poised to happen, it also had a number of positive tipping points, and one of them was the growth of the global climate justice movement. So in that sense, Dubai was not a total loss, but it certainly was not a strong step forward.
Eleanor, there are criticisms that the COP28 report does not address issues of inequality with respect to both the causes of climate change and those nations and peoples suffering the worst consequences of it so far. In this regard, how does the COP28 report differ from that of the recent Oxfam report, a report that does focus on inequality and the role played by the global elite in both causing the climate crisis and in preventing real solutions.
Well, you're absolutely right that that is a striking contrast between those two reports. But it's not a surprise because the COP28 report represents a kind of rocky, uneven, strange bedfellows consensus of basically all the nations in the world in terms of analysis of the causes of climate change, which it doesn't really address, and analysis of the measures that will be necessary to address it. On the other hand, it's significant because it is a treaty. It is, or in the nature of a treaty, it's a global agreement, which almost all the nations of the world have, you know, signed their names to, including all the major emitters. And in this conversation, I would just like to focus our lens on fossil fuels and the fossil fuel industry, because when all is said and done, if you had to say one thing that has to be done to address the climate crisis, it is to get off fossil fuels, especially in this country and other parts of the global north. The renowned climate scientist Michael Mann from the University of Pennsylvania has said that if we can reduce our fossil fuel use to zero or close to zero, the repair process on the part of the climate will be very rapid, and it could be a matter of just a few years until temperature stabilizes closer to historical levels. So that is not only the most important because 85% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the world come from the burning fossil fuels, it is also the most efficacious because it will have a very fast result. So the Oxfam report I have been using everywhere, it's a great piece of work, and they point out many things, but I'll just pick out two things to look at. One is the fact that the richest 10% of people in the world produce around half of all global emissions, and the poorest half of the world's population, about 3.5 billion people, is responsible for only 10% of carbon emissions. You have to think about that, especially when you're talking to people who say population control is the problem with climate. I would agree if we're talking about control of the population of the 10% richest people in the world, but that isn't usually what people mean when they talk about population control. But that's just kind of a shocking fact. Another is that a mere 100 companies are responsible for 3/4 of global emissions, and they spend millions, probably hundreds of millions, lobbying against climate action in all the developed countries. So clearly there's an inequity here that is at the root of the problem.
Eleanor, here in corporate America, we constantly hear, though, about various measures undertaken that will supposedly slow or even turn the tide of climate change, it's claimed sometimes. There's no electric cars, the trading of pollution credits between industrial corporations in the U.S. Oh, plant more trees, more roof gardens on our buildings, develop more environmentally friendly plastics. I mean, is there any evidence that these measures, which I think everybody admits are pretty modest at best, and others like them, really could be sufficient to solve the climate crisis that we're facing? I mean, in the view of climate change scientists, I never get the impression that they're all that impressed with them. What do you think?
Well, you know, of that list of admittedly, apparently minor changes in behavior, I would pick out one thing, and that is electric vehicles. Because actually, if you look at the Tipping Point report, they list the growing use, really the exponential increase in use of electric vehicles as a positive tipping point. And it's actually an interesting point about the whole report that they have positive tipping points because transformation to electric vehicles away from internal combustion cars can, as we decarbonize our generation of electricity, can vastly improve our record on getting rid of fossil fuel. So that one, I would say, is of critical importance.
I must note, I'm glad you said that, but I must note that there was just a big report in the New York Times yesterday and the day before that the production of electric cars, the sale of electric cars in the United States and in certain other countries as well, at the moment I confess I don't know which ones they mentioned, are rather dramatically decreasing for any number of reasons that they point out. And yet certainly what you say about the value, if in fact we could turn the car transportation industry into all electric, no one can doubt what you've said about that. But I'm just saying, on a cautionary note, at the moment that seems to be slowed after having accelerated considerably in this country. I'm sorry, Maria, go ahead.
Eleanor, when we were discussing your appearance today on Law and Disorder, you mentioned you wanted to discuss the role that war, genocide, and ecocide play in diverting the world's attention from climate change. Is what happened at COP28 an example of this diversion of attention issue?
I think COP28 didn't help, but I think it's a broader question than that. I mean, start with the fact that, the little-known fact that when countries do their inventories of their greenhouse gas emissions, they omit emissions from the military sector. So in the United States, the same way that defense expenditures are not counted in the national budget, greenhouse gas emissions from the military are not counted in the national inventory. And this is true of most countries in the world. And in the United States, for example, the U.S. military is the largest consumer of fossil fuels in the world. And yet we don't count its emissions. And that's even standing still. But when our military machinery and the armaments industry are ratcheted up the way they are right now, we're looking at massive fossil fuel emissions around the world. And, of course, that is secondary to the terrible deaths of more than 25,000 people in Gaza and others that are as a result of global wars. And we are in a very precarious position right now, as I'm sure you know, in terms of, you know, the potential of launching into really a global war. But there's another aspect to that, which is, and the Tipping Points report is good at this. The Tipping Points report urges the formation of a new form of global governance to address these tipping points on an emergency basis. And what's happening is so much the opposite of that, where, you know, the United States has isolated itself globally alongside its client state, Israel, and the very few others that support the war in Gaza. And on many other fronts, we see states of war around the world. And that is an incredibly precarious state when you're looking at facing climate disaster that could really only be addressed with international cooperation. There is no other way to address it. And, you know, the United States' ability and Europe's ability, for that matter, to play any kind of constructive role in bringing nations together at this point is, it's a joke. It's a joke because the United States is so, it's become a rogue state. If we had a leadership in this country that was putting climate first, the last thing they would do would be support military incursions and engage in military incursions. So I see that as a tremendously dangerous road, not only for the main reason, which is, of course, the deaths of people in Gaza and elsewhere, but because of the impact on the ability to reach global alliances.
I really thank you for that point, by the way, Eleanor. I confess, I read a lot about that. I hadn't thought of that. I haven't seen it discussed elsewhere, and I think you're obviously right. And yikes, there are certainly global conflicts constantly. This particular war is front and center at the moment, but there's hardly a moment when some of what you're talking about that flows from the current war flows from even some of these smaller skirmishes that are going on. So I really thank you for raising that. But I'm certainly no authority on climate change, believe me, and what must be done if the worst consequences of it had been avoided. But I must say, it does seem to me, and I'm not alone in this regard, that as I've watched the way the corporatist, capitalist, bottom-line world, the U.S. and other such countries, have gone about addressing the issue, or, well, more accurately, not really addressing the issue, at least not in a meaningful enough way. I do despair of the world ever doing enough before it is too late for much to be done. Am I just now old and cynical? Is it possible to have a world where the most powerful nations are still effectively run or controlled by for-profit international corporate conglomerates and still expect to adequately address climate change in time? In short, can it be solved in a world dominated by capitalism?
You know, I don't start from the starting point of what can we expect. I start from the starting point of how do we make change and what are the forces that are making change? Because there, I don't think you could point to any country with any social and economic system in the world, possibly with the exception of Cuba, that is not based to a very significant degree on extractive industries and on a fossil fuel economy and that path of development. That's our given. So the question is, you know, I don't expect them to do anything unless we force them to do it. And that's not that sounds like a trivial answer, but it really isn't. I think, you know, as I said, the tipping point report is interesting because it does point to the growth of a global and united climate justice movement as a positive tipping point and as the kind of thing that can move mountains over time. And, of course, we all know that from our own history. And just today, I read in the New York Times this wonderful account of the White House putting off a decision that they were about to push forward to build a basically the world's biggest liquid natural gas export facility in Louisiana, CP2, an enormous project. It has been described by carbon activists as a carbon time bomb. It's to export natural gas, which is methane, which is 85 times as potent a greenhouse gas forcer than carbon dioxide, and that leaks, you know, famously at the production point, at the liquefaction point, at the use point. This kind of these investments, which were all announced as a group by Biden, are, you know, really counteract any progress we can make on climate through the Inflation Reduction Act, which, by the way, contains the passive ability to make a lot of advances, but it was completely undercut by this move to build more oil and gas facilities. And so this has met with opposition on the level of the opposition to the Keystone pipeline, and it looks like this decision is going to be postponed, and that often is the precursor of being denied. But of course, that may turn on the outcome of the November election. So the other thing I'd say is that, you know, it is a report, and the tipping point report points this out. We're talking about making some fundamental changes in how the world societies run. Getting off fossil fuel is not simple. The good news is that we know we can do it because we have the level of renewable energy, solar and wind, offshore wind, has grown enormously over the last 10, 20 years. It's now cheaper than fossil fuel, and it's widely available. And so we have built up the possibility to replace gas and oil. We have the technology. It's not a technological issue. It's really a question of forcing the great fossil majors to make the changes that have to be made to basically prohibit them from carrying out their business as usual. And that's the real challenge we have ahead of us.
Eleanor Stein, given what you've said so far, given the framework you've described, what is the responsibility of progressive organizations and individuals here in the United States, and for that matter, all over the world, if climate change is to be properly addressed in ways that would actually provide us with hope and relief?
Well, this year, I would say vote. There are elections going on all over the world, not only here. And ours, of course, is very significant, but so are many of the others. Try to keep out the deniers and the oil burners and the drillers who are resurgent all around the world, along with their, you know, proto-fascist nativist base. Critical is to try to keep in power governments that will make some changes And I would say right now, I think we need to link our peace movement with our climate justice movement, because they really are inextricably linked. We can't have climate justice and war. You know, climate justice, the climate justice agenda points to a more peaceable, greener, healthier, more equitable society than the one we're living in now for many, many countries. And we need to keep that vision in mind and try to unite all of our movements in ways that center both opposing war and fighting climate change. If we can do that, I think we can really have an effect.
Well, Eleanor Stein, this has been really informative, and we really do thank you so much. But where can our listeners learn more? Where should they go? Where might you direct them to? What websites or writings or what, so that our listeners could be, well, better informed and therefore hopefully more a part of that progressive movement demanding the kind of changes that we need to keep making if we're going to solve the issue?
I can give you my short list of who I'm looking to for guidance today, the changes. One is thirdact.org, which is Bill McKibben's latest project focused on using our powers as investors or money savers to pressure banks and credit card companies to stop financing the fossil fuel industry. And they have a really creative bunch of popular actions that anyone can do in your community. I'd also suggest anything Bill McKibben is writing and anything that Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, is writing, usually in The New Yorker, always worth seeing. And actually, the New York Times climate feed is fantastic, really worth following. Other organizations, Sunrise, which is a young people's organization, and, of course, WEACT, that's WEACT.org. That is the Harlem-based environmental justice organization that has attended the last two COPs and is a leading force for global unity and action on climate change in this country as well.
Thank you again for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
It was a pleasure, as always.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.